It's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For every orchestra in the United States, there are approximately 250 choirs. Choral music is big, inclusive, and vibrant. Later this hour, I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio's Barney Sherman about his latest project. It's called Choral Iowa. But first, the North American Review is the oldest surviving literary magazine in the United States, and it's headquartered right here in Iowa. The Review was founded in Boston in 1815, but it moved to Cedar Falls, Iowa in 1969 at the University of Northern Iowa, and it's still going strong. Jeremy Schraffenberger, editor of the North American Review and associate professor of English at the University of Northern Iowa, is with me. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Charity. It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Also with us, Rachel Morgan, poetry editor of the North American Review and an instructor in the Department of Languages and Literature at UNI. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you both for being here. And Jeremy, I want to start with the history of the North American Review. As I mentioned, it was founded in Boston in 1815. So let's go way back in time. How did it start?
Well, you know, it is a long history, so I'll try to give you a kind of capsule of the history, and if you want to follow up with some of the details, I'm happy to do so. So it was founded in 1815 by a group of men who were associated with Harvard, and it kind of remained a Harvard publication for most of the 19th century. It had a kind of gentlemanly review quality about it. It eventually took on a kind of conservative, sort of a dull tone until it moved to New York City in 1878. And there it kind of changed its, changed its mission, and it became much more of a commercial magazine that wanted to take on issues of the day, controversies of the day. And then in 1940, the magazine actually stopped being published. And this is an interesting part of the history. If you want to know more about it, I'm happy to go into detail. But its editor was arrested in the lead up to World War II for serving as a Japanese agent. And so he spent years in prison, and the magazine went under.
Wow.
And then in 1964, the poet Robert Dana, who taught for many years, was the poet laureate, taught at Cornell College here in Iowa, resurrected the magazine.
Well, let's talk about that resurrection in 1964, because it strikes me as a little strange at that point in time to resurrect the North American Review instead of just founding a new magazine. What was Robert Dana's goal then?
Well, I think his goal was to take advantage of the long history and reputation of the North American Review. From its very founding, it was a magazine that was interested in discovering, promoting, and also helping to shape American literature, what is uniquely American. And I think Dana wanted to bring to the heartland, bring to the center of the country, that same mission. And so that kind of still informs what we do today. We're looking for the unique, diverse voices all across the country. And so if he had founded a review that was associated with the Midwest, it might feel more regional or parochial. And so even the name North American Review is expansive.
All right. So even though it had really died out, that name still carried cachet and history.
Absolutely.
And stature.
Absolutely. I think in the 60s, you would have still had people who would have been subscribers and remembered the name.
So in 1969, the North American Review moved to the University of Northern Iowa. How did that happen?
Well, that was around the time the University of Northern Iowa became the University of Northern Iowa. And so the president at the time, Bill Marker, I think wisely made the decision to purchase the magazine from Cornell College.
And that transition was from the State Teachers College to the university. It wasn't
exactly.
It wasn't when the university itself
exactly,
started.
Exactly, right, but when the name the university. So this new name, this new identity of a university needed something that had a lot of cultural cachet to say, hey, look, we're doing some important things also.
So that that brings us then to 50 years at the University of Northern Iowa. You'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the North American Review at the University of Northern Iowa coming up this spring. What do you think the modern mission is of the North American Review?
Well, the modern mission actually is still informed by that initial mission to discover what it is, what the voices are out there writing, you know, poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, and to promote those voices. We also have a new mission to, you know, to be open, to be transparent, but also to invite as many people. So the conference, we're having a conference in the spring, as you mentioned, to celebrate 50 years. And the theme of that conference is The Open Space of Democracy, which was a book published by Terry Tempest Williams about a decade ago. She'll be the keynote to the conference. And so we're sort of taking advantage of the idea of the open space of democracy. And that's kind of become our new guiding star, our new mission.
And how did you get involved? When did you come?
Well, I was hired at the university in 2008. And, you know, I knew the University of Northern Iowa, even though I was in grad school in upstate New York. I knew of the University of Northern Iowa because of the North American Review and because of the James Hirst Poetry Prize, for instance. So, you know, it carried a lot of weight for me. When I was hired in 2008, I began working as the assistant poetry editor and then sort of worked my way into different roles, became associate editor, and then took on a little bit more responsibility in 2015 when we celebrated the bicentennial. So we had a conference very similar to the one we're going to have here in April.
Tell me about the relationship between the University of Northern Iowa and the North American Review.
So the North American Review is owned by the university, so we're completely a university organization. We're organized in the Department of Languages and Literature. So part of my faculty job is to work on the magazine, which includes mentoring students and working with them in a kind of laboratory situation. So students do get kind of hands-on experience in editing and publishing and corresponding with writers. And so it's a professional experience, but it's also a pedagogical experience. It's also a classroom kind of experience. And so that's my role as both faculty and editor. So it's kind of a dual role.
And you're a poet yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't get to write as much as I like to nowadays, but I'm primarily a poet, also a nonfiction writer.
Well, and Rachel Morgan, as I mentioned, is also here with us, also a poet and the poetry editor for the North American Review. Rachel, for people who haven't picked up the North American Review, who are learning about it for the first time, what's an issue like?
An issue is, I think, you're going to see poetry, creative nonfiction, and fiction. And we're a little bit different in that we're still published like a magazine. You see a lot of journals that are perfect bound. We have art in the issue. And one of the exciting things I think that we're doing currently is we're curating certain sections with other editors. So we look at our history, which is a long history, and we look towards our future as well. And one of the things that we're doing is becoming more inclusive with our voices. And so we've had people curate sections for us, like Hyde Erdrich has curated a collection of First Nation poets. Meta Sama has curated a section of African American poets. Joyelle McSweeney has curated a section of poets in translation. Eduardo Corral has curated a section of Canadian poets. So I think that you'll see that we're a very inclusive and growing magazine that has its pulse on what's happening also in contemporary literature.
When you pick up the magazine, as you mentioned, it looks like a magazine. Is there a perfect balance, a formula that you try to put together with each publication?
A lot of it is about space. We work with students in Adobe InDesign, so there's a lot of, it becomes very technical about layout and how many poems can you fit or how many lines or how many columns can you lay out. So there's actually what seems like, you know, literature, it's kind of math that becomes involved in it as well. In any issue, for example, we can probably have about 15 to 20 poems and about, depending on how long the fiction pieces are, say 2 to 4, and for creative nonfiction, 1 to 2. So we all sit down as editors when we are laying out the magazine, and we talk a little bit about balance. And there are certain issues, like this spring is when we publish the Hearst Poetry Prize winner. The summer is the fiction issue. We also have a torch contest for creative nonfiction.
A torch contest. What does that mean?
Oh, it's the torch prize. Okay. So for creative nonfiction.
And how often do you publish?
We publish 4 times a year.
You mentioned students working on the project. I know, as Jeremy was saying, this is part of the University of Northern Iowa. How much of a role, Jeremy, do students have in publishing this magazine?
Oh, they have a primary role. So students get a variety of different experiences when they come into the office. They're first introduced to the magazine by reading the submissions that come in from all over the country. We get thousands of submissions all over the country from writers, well-known or unknown. So that's the first thing we want to do. We say, hey, you're going to be working at a literary magazine. Let's see what literature looks like and talk about how to judge what we want to publish or not. So they get a kind of editorial experience. And then some of them...
And how many eyes are on each submission?
So, we get multiple eyes, usually in pairs.
not just freshmen
right,
students,
no.
Right?
So we do make a commitment to our contributors, to anybody submitting to us, that, we do have students working on reading submissions, but nothing ever gets rejected unless an editor has read it first. So that we allow students in on the process, but we do have editorial oversight. But that's the first experience some of them are getting reading contemporary literature. They may be readers, but they might not know what is being published right now. So that's part of the conversation. And some students get more experience in the business side of things too. So they're interested in marketing or advertising, and others have obvious experience in graphic design, or some of them want to work in our social media, with social media. And so students come in, they get the same experience, and then they sort of branch out and find their niche.
And about how many students do you have working with you in a given semester?
So a given semester, 10 to 12. Right now, we're currently kind of rebranding, redesigning the experience. So that what we want to do is get more students in the office. So we can only accommodate so many, literally, physically accommodate so many of them. So we're trying to develop a practicum where we can accommodate more. So my desire would be to have as many students as possible down there.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking right now about the North American Review. It's the oldest surviving literary magazine in the United States. It's been in Cedar Falls, Iowa, at the University of Northern Iowa since 1969. It's celebrated 200 years in publication, and now, this spring, it will celebrate 50 years in the state of Iowa. With me, Jeremy Schraffenberger, editor of the North American Review, associate professor of English at the University of Northern Iowa, and Rachel Morgan, poetry editor of the North American Review and also an instructor in the Department of Languages and Literature at UNI. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, Choral Iowa, a new project from Iowa Public Radio Classical. I'll be talking with Barney Sherman, one of our senior music producers in classical music. Of course, you hear him in the afternoons on Iowa Public Radio's classical music stream. Right now, we're talking about the North American Review. It's the oldest surviving literary magazine in the United States. It was founded in Boston in 1815, but moved to Cedar Falls, Iowa in 1969, part of the University of Northern Iowa. With me, Rachel Morgan, poetry editor of the North American Review and instructor in the Department of Languages and Literature at UNI, and Jeremy Schraffenberger, editor of the North American Review and associate professor of English at the University of Northern Iowa. And I know that you've both brought a little bit of poetry with you to read today. And Rachel, I was wondering if you'd read your selection. For people who haven't picked up the North American Review, maybe it'll give us an idea of what we find inside those pages.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. And I should say that it's called the James Hearst Poetry Prize. I'm going to read the poem that won the 2017 James Hearst Poetry Prize. But James Hearst is a figure that's important to Cedar Falls as well as to the magazine. So he is a poet. He was called the Robert Frost of the Midwest. And he writes a lot of Midwestern sort of pastoral, farm life, rural sort of bucolic poetry. And he also taught here. And this prize honors the work that he did at the university and the poetry that he wrote. And this is from the 2017 winner. And it's an amazing little ekphrastic poem. It's pretty short. And the epigraph reads, "After Glenn," by Jean-Michel Basquiat, 1985. And it's by Jordan Franklin, and the poem is called Black Boy. The choleric shakes of his reprimand careen, from thought to larynx, his love is mayhem. It sparks the ritual burning of branched fingers, once plump with olives. When the whistling stops, the tree must relearn its true weight and dislodge his tired, dark fruit. Fire is his sacrament, its home the stoked back of his throat. His crown of barbed wire forms a brooch across his neck. His fruit, not even the starved birds will eat.
Black Boy by Jordan Franklin, winner of the 2017 James Hurst Poetry Prize. And I know that you were talking earlier about submissions coming into the office, students reading submissions, but also, of course, the editors looking at submissions. How many submissions do you get? How many writers are clamoring to try to be part of the North American Review?
More and more. One of the most amazing experiences I think that we've all had as editors when we go to a conference like AWP, for example, a writer will come up to us and say, "You were my first publication." And that's probably one of the greatest things that you can hear as an editor. And I've heard people say, "I know I've made it when I've been accepted into the North American Review." So we do run on an academic calendar, so we're open during the school year. So we start in the fall, and this is speaking of poetry, we start accepting submissions for the James Hurst Poetry Prize in August, and we close that in late October. And then we switch to regular submissions. And so for the remainder of the academic year, we're open for regular submissions. It's about 6 months total. And when I look at the numbers, it's astounding. I read every single submission, and that means that I could read, and this is thinking about it through the whole, like, 52-week year, I could read 156 poems per week. So that's how many submissions that we get.
Wow.
And when the students will read it, we usually have two, if not three, student readers, and I read everything. And so then we select the poems that really stand out to us, and then we will have meetings with the students, and we'll talk about, you know, all the poems that get to this point are great, you know, but what makes them ready to be published? What makes them ready to be in the pages of the North American Review? And that's a really great conversation to have with students.
Is there also recruitment going on? Do you reach out to writers that you want to feature in the North American Review?
We have a good contributing editor, Martine Espada, who oftentimes will send us work. And so we communicate with a lot of our contributing editors. And when we curate certain sections, when we turn it over to another editor, so they may solicit work from other people, like when we turned over the issue to Eduardo Corral, and, you know, he might solicit work from some Canadian poets, for example.
You were talking earlier about trying to make sure that you're being representative, that you're getting diverse voices. I can imagine that that does take work, that does take outreach, because there are people who may not feel empowered to submit their poetry to the North American Review.
Yeah, I think so. It's one thing is working in our favor. I think it's certainly an exciting time for poetry right now. It's going through a little bit of a renaissance.
What makes you say that?
The National Endowment for the Arts in 2017, they do this survey every 5 years. It's called the Survey of Public Participation in the Arts. And for basically a generation, poetry reading is at an all-time high at about 12%. And this is across all ages, all educational backgrounds, urban, rural, and different ethnic groups. So we see that a lot is happening. So poetry is having a little bit of a moment. And when the NAA found this out, one of the questions they were asking, well, why is this? And I think a lot of it has to do with certain presses being aware that, you know, some other more privileged voices have been published for a long time. and it's time to look for other voices. And social media, the ability to share work, the fact that presses are paying attention to voices that have been marginalized, the poetry out loud in high schools. And I think the work of some of the poets laureate has also been really powerful. For example, Billy Collins did his Poetry 180, and that was a program. So each poet laureate has sort of a mission or a cause. And so when Collins was a poet laureate, he said, let's read a poem every day in school and not analyze it, just hear it. And right now, Tracy Smith, who's the fifth African-American to hold the title, is taking poetry to rural places where it otherwise writers wouldn't go and give a tour and reading.
Do you feel like there's a divide between literary poetry and popular poetry?
The world does. As a poetry editor, I think it's my job to be open to everything. But you will see, I think, people, you know, each to their own. Some people feel that way. You know, so somebody might submit a slam poem over Submittable, right? And so it's my job to read that on the page, you know, without the performative aspect to it.
And Jeremy, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do a little name dropping here. Let's talk about some of the writers who've been published in the North American Review over the years, people whose names a lot of us would recognize.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I always make the case that if you read the North American Review, you may as well just be reading an anthology of American literature. And this goes back to the very beginning, from Washington Irving and William Cullen Bryant and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Walt Whitman, but also Mark Twain, and then later in the 20th century, John Steinbeck, and then later still, Kurt Vonnegut. And it was really in the mid-20th century that it really got a reputation as a venue for the most important short story writers to be publishing. So Raymond Carver and Joyce Carol Oates, Margaret Atwood, Barry Lopez, as Louise Erdrich. I mean, really the list does go on. And so we're lucky to have that reputation, because that sort of attracts more, you know, the more that you publish good work, the more good work you get. Which also, I think, speaks to what you were just discussing with Rachel about diversity. So the more diverse voices you publish, the more that you receive without solicitation.
Tell me a little bit about your readership. Who reads the North American Review?
You know, we did a survey recently, and we found that it's from all over the country, but there is still a New England base of subscribers. We do, and we have a lot of library subscriptions, so that suggests that it's getting read by people more than just the people who subscribe. But in the survey, we found that people were likely to be a little bit older, likely to be a little bit more well off. You know, they have the extra income to subscribe to a literary magazine. And so our goal is to continue inviting those people to the party, but then also to branch out a little bit and invite younger audiences. And so, for instance, we're having this conference in April, as I mentioned earlier, April 19th through the 21st here on campus. It's going to be free and open to anybody who wants to come. And so that's one way we're trying to say, okay, anybody is welcome. Come and listen to all of these writers. Come listen to people talk about writing. And then do some writing yourself as well.
When you celebrated the centennial of the North American Review, that also marked the launch of a new publishing wing of the North American Review. Tell me about that.
Right. So in the 70s and 80s, there had been the NAR Press, the North American Review Press, which published a number of books. But then in the 90s into the 2000s, it was dormant. And so we took the opportunity when we turned 200 to relaunch the North American Review Press. So we published a book called The Great Sympathetic, Walt Whitman and the North American Review. And that collected the essays that Whitman had published in the magazine over the years, as well as some pieces about Walt Whitman and some poems that are inspired or influenced by Walt Whitman. And because we felt it was a success, we said, well, okay, let's start publishing books. Now, we're not publishing with a real aggressive agenda, but we do have a number of different focuses. So we'll continue to publish works that celebrate the history of the magazine, But we recently launched an imprint called Gas Station Pulp, and it publishes crime noir fiction. But it's not just crime noir. It's crime noir that kind of puts a twist on the genre that makes it slightly more, I suppose you could say, slightly more literary. But we also, you know, have an imprint about the craft of writing. So we have a book that collects essays about the craft of fiction. And we have in mind, although we haven't done this yet, this is going to be after the conference, but we have in mind to start a poetry book contest. This is going to take some time, some work, and some money too, obviously. So those things are in the works.
There have been a number of local presses in Iowa that have shut down over the last 20 years. What has changed? Why was 2015 the right time to relaunch the North American Review Press?
Well, I think the technology is much less expensive, honestly. So in the past, there had been the print-on-demand technology, which may have been affordable, but the quality wasn't quite there. But now the technology is inexpensive and it's a high-quality product. And so we saw it as both affordable and a good time to sort of celebrate. And I think that's the case across the country with small presses, small literary presses. More and more of them are going to a print-on-demand model rather than printing a bunch at the press and then having to store boxes and boxes of books. We can have a small order and then order a few at a time as needed.
Now, of course, another thing that has changed dramatically in recent years is how people access content. So many of us are doing that online. What's your online presence like?
So we do have a new website. We have an online issue as well. So we have exclusive content online that people can read. We kind of like to use it as a way to point toward the print magazine, and then the print magazine points toward the website and the online issue. And we're actually undergoing right now a redesign of the website, so it's going to be bigger and better and more accessible than ever.
Are you looking to broach that barrier and get outside sort of the academic community?
It's a conversation, I think, that we have, and a lot of journals and a lot of presses might even be having, of paper versus digital. And that it's a really important conversation to have as we watch, say, for example, newspapers and magazine subscriptions struggle a little bit. And it's been very interesting to us as we accept things for print. Some of the poets are really happy about that. And then some might not be happy about being published online, but some might prefer it. So what we see is when we look at our circulation, right? So when you're published in print, the people that purchase the magazine can see your work. But when it's online, we see that it's easily shared across social media, all of the various platforms. And one of the, I think, probably most robust parts of our website is the blog. And that's where we ask our published writers to add some sort of commentary about the piece or craft. And we see that that's widely shared, widely circulated, and increasingly so. We're seeing the numbers go up for online publication. And when we first started publishing online in 2016, there might have been a little more, a little more hesitant perspective from the people who are being published online. But now I don't really notice that at all. People are happy to be published because it's easily circulated and read that way.
What do you think it means to have this publication in Iowa?
I think Iowa's had a long tradition of being friendly to the literary arts. You see the emergence of the Iowa Writers' Workshop after World War II. And so in many ways, Iowa becomes synonymous with writing. And all of the Regents schools have a literary magazine. And it just so happens that UNI has the oldest one. And I think it's our job to be a good steward of the magazine while it's here.
Is there any pressure being part of a Regents University? Is there pressure on the North American Review, budgetary pressure on the review?
No, we do get support. Part of our professional development as faculty in the department is to be assigned to work on this publication. And we, you know, this is one of the reasons it's used as a laboratory for student learning, that it actually is valuable beyond its artistic merit, beyond its effect in the world. It also helps students gain valuable skills. It also introduces them to the beauty and strangeness of literature and art. We also do have money coming in through JSTOR, which is a database that archives all of our back pages. And so we get regular royalty checks from them. So we're not completely self-supporting because, for instance, I get compensated for the work that I do with the magazine, but we also contribute our fair share, and we're always hustling to write grants and to help support ourselves to be good stewards, but also good citizens.
We have less than a minute left. Jeremy, what's the one thing that you're most excited about in the future of the North American Review?
I'm excited for this conference because it's a time that we're going to unveil the new North American Review. We're going to have a new format, a new design, a new mission. And so the celebration is about being new, is about being reborn in the spring.
Jeremy Schraffenberger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Rachel Morgan, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy Schraffenberger, editor of the North American Review and associate professor of English at the University of Northern Iowa. Rachel Morgan, poetry editor of the North American Review and instructor in the Department of Languages and Literature at UNI. The North American Review is the oldest surviving literary magazine in the United States, and it's based at UNI in Cedar Falls. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This time of year, choirs and choruses all over the state of Iowa are presenting their winter concerts, and a lot of Iowans will be performing. Iowa Public Radio senior music producer Barney Sherman has been exploring the choral scene in Iowa and has just launched a new project called Choral Iowa. Of course, you can hear Barney during the afternoons, Sunday through Friday, on Iowa Public Radio Classical. He is with me now. Hello, Barney.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And tell me where the idea for Choral Iowa came from.
Well, it's something that was percolating. I think everybody at IPR these days thinks a lot about mission, about why we're here, how we can do that even better. And one thing I'd been noticing is that my colleague Jacqueline Hallblum does such an amazing job with Symphonies of Iowa and opera and with much of the art scene, but that I felt I needed to do more with our choral scene. I'd become aware of just how big a thing it is.
Well, and paint me a picture. How big is choral music?
I was kind of amazed when I started to look into the reports, but put it this way, for every orchestra in America, it appears there are something like 260 choirs, and something like one out of five households has at least one choral singer. So if you're listening, do you know somebody who sings in a choir? The chances are you do. It's a very inclusive art form. And Iowa is, as it happens, one of the centers of gravity for this, the upper Midwest. Our collegiate programs are national leaders. We have really high rates of participation in school choirs as well, it'd be pre-college. We have one of the best choral directors associations, the Iowa Choral Directors Association. There's a lot happening here. Influential people in choral conducting and composing come from Iowa. So that there is something that's very much there.
Define choral music for me. I mean, is it just any music performed with the voice?
Yeah, it's people singing together. And one of the great things about it is the diversity of it. There's specific traditions of choral singing. For example, choruses that are just sing without accompaniment, it's called a cappella. Turns out that that's a specialty of the upper Midwest. There are glee clubs and oratorio societies, gospel music, and also, I've just like this last month in November, the biggest choral visitor was the Soweto Gospel Choir from South Africa. The thing about, say, with many classical forms like the orchestra is that the infrastructure is pretty expensive. But for choral singing, the infrastructure is built into our bodies. So, yeah, it can take many forms.
Why do you think the Midwest is such a hotbed for this kind of music? What do you think about us culturally?
It has to do with accidents, really, of migration patterns, particularly in the St. Olaf's College in Northfield and Luther College in Decorah, there was a certain, it was partly migration patterns and partly very influential people. There was a person named F. Melius Christiansen at St. Olaf's who really pioneered a kind of college a cappella singing with high standards and broadcasting. We'll be carrying the St. Olaf Christmas concert this year and that of Luther College. So there are those kinds of influences. That's part of the reason, but there are really many, many different influences in Iowa choral music as there is in choral music everywhere. People in many parts of the state take part in this.
Well, you have brought with you today a couple of really extraordinary examples of choral music from Iowa. Why don't we play a little something, and why don't you tell us about your first selection?
Well, I am assuming that it is the choir Hymn to the Eternal Flame from To Be Certain of the Dawn. Now, this was written by Stephen Paulus, a Minnesota composer, died just recently, and I picked this. It features the Wartburg College Choir, led by Lee Nelson. I have heard this remarkable oratorio, which was written in 2005. I've heard it twice in concert here in Iowa, one at Iowa Wesleyan, led by Jamie Spillane, included a number of choral groups from Southeast Iowa. And then in 2013, Jason Weinberger led the WCF Symphony and the Wartburg Choir, the Metropolitan Chorale of Cedar Valley, the Cedar Valley Youth Honor Chorus. It was one of the most moving concerts I had ever been to. So it's an example of how this is one of the things that excited me about choral music is that it's a very creative field with lots of new music that really touches people. This particular passage, the Hymn to the Eternal Flame, I should mention the words were written by a University of Iowa graduate named Michael Dennis Brown. He wrote the text. And the Hymn to the Eternal Flame is inspired by the Children's Memorial of Candles at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. Here it is.
So that's just a little selection of To Be Certain of the Dawn. And Barney, give me an idea of, we've said this is a new project, but what is Choral Iowa? You've been sharing a web post every week to share some of the new developments in choral music in Iowa, right?
Yeah, I think of Choral Iowa as, at this point, a sort of work in progress, a kind of an experiment. I can tell you how it started. Have I given you the background story?
No.
I'd been thinking about this for a while, and a listener named Doug Reed got in touch with me. He had just retired to Ames. He'd been conducting The Lion King on Broadway for years, and so he was now in Ames, and he heard an Iowa choral concert in Minnesota, some of our top choirs. He wondered about how we could bring that to the air. I said, hey, let's talk, and we chatted, and I mentioned the idea of a conference call with choral music people to see if we could get something started. The next thing I knew, Doug had organized it. So we had a couple of conference calls. Choral directors were very enthusiastic, and they could become all kinds of things in the future. But what we've delivered so far is every week, basically, there's a topic page at Iowa Public Radio called Choral Iowa. It might have been called a blog in the past. And every week, there's some new content. And some of it has been written by people in the choral scene. That's my main hope, is that it will not be written by me, but Jill Wilson, the head of the Iowa Choral Directors Association. She's from Luther College. She wrote the first one. John Romerheim of Grinnell, who's a great choral composer and conductor and scholar, about a really remarkable find in the archives at Grinnell in the origins of their choral music. I felt it gave some insight into Iowa history as well. Then we've also had a piece about a choral work recorded by the Drake Chamber Choir, led by Amy Beckman Collier, another great choral conductor, written recently about the story of somebody immigrating to Iowa in 1899, looking at their draft card for information about them that provided the poetic spark. And then last night,
before we move on, you also brought a sample of that for us to hear, right?
Yes, here it is. Okay, so it's called, and I'm probably going to say it wrong, it's Norwegian, Over Havet, Over the Sea. It's mostly in English, except the parts about the ocean. The subject of this, Peter Mandius Nerland, his great-grandchild of his is a choral conductor. So he commissioned this, and the poets looked at all the stuff he could get, noticed on the man's draft card from 1917 that his eyes were listed as gray, and he realized, well, the Atlantic Ocean looks that way too. And the music, it evokes the steamship, it evokes the ocean, the new country, the feeling. It's kind of a haunting piece of music, very evocative, and what a performance by the Drake Chamber Choir and Amy Beckman Collier.
All right, let's listen. Selection of Over Havet by Dan Forrest. That's the Drake Chamber Choir, led by Dr. Amy Beckman Collier, from their new album, This Is a Good World. And of course, you can find out more about the backstory to that performance and that music on iowapublicradio.org, Choral Iowa. Look for Choral Iowa. You can see all of the posts that Barney has been putting together about, and others have been putting together about choral music in Iowa. And Barney, I know you want this to be part of a bigger conversation about choral music in Iowa. So I know you've reached out to a lot of choral directors, but you're hoping to reach a little bit farther as well. What's your vision?
I would love to hear from people who sing in choirs or maybe just love choral music. We're hoping to list every choral event in Iowa. I put together a list for November, about 30 events turned up. I'm going to do that for December. There will be a lot of them. I'll be posting that on Friday, I hope. And we've actually, our colleague Matt Siren just provided an email address, choraliowa, all one word, at iowapublicradio.org. Choral Iowa, iowapublicradio.org. If there's something you would like to share, an idea or or if you know about a choral event, let us know. We want to include your voice.
Well, and let's talk just a little bit about your most recent web post as well that just went up last night about a really remarkable choral composer here in Iowa. Tell me about that.
Elaine Hagenberg, who is in Des Moines, she graduated from Drake in 2002 in music education. And one of the great things about choral music is that a person in Des Moines can become an internationally admired composer. Her music has been published by places like Oxford University Press and Schirmer. It's been performed in London, Melbourne, New York. And next week, December 8th, St. Ambrose in Des Moines, the Des Moines Choral Society will be premiering a new work of hers. It happened that our colleague Jacqueline Hallbloom had done an interview with her about a piece she wrote for the Heartland Youth Choir. The fact that youth are so involved in choral music in Iowa is another thing I love about it. So she chose a poem from Elaine Jungers of Sheldon, Iowa, called "See How the Rose Unfolds." You can get the backstory on that on the latest post. It exemplifies so much of what I see in choral music, including the fact that it seems to me closer to gender balance and inclusiveness of both urban and rural and of people of all age groups and backgrounds. She is a remarkable musician in her own right. She's an educator, significant educator as well. So that's this week's post.
In starting to really explore choral music in Iowa in a new way, have you been surprised?
Yeah, constantly. I think I came to Iowa Public Radio from a background in the more standard forms of music, piano and orchestra, and being in Iowa is where I realized that choral music wasn't just the great masterpieces of the past. It's very much a thriving, very lively scene with a lot of creative new elements that I hadn't realized before that very much touch people, that communicate to non-experts, that people in small communities as well as big ones love. I think it's underreported by the national music press. And I think we can make a difference here in Iowa in making sure that it does get the attention it deserves, especially here.
All right. And if people have exciting things they want to share with you, choraliowa at iowapublicradio.org is the the email address. And of course, you can go to our website, iowapublicradio.org, and look for Choral Iowa. You can see all of the web posts we've been talking about with links to interviews and music in some cases. Barney Sherman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Charity.
Barney Sherman, senior music producer with Iowa Public Radio Classical. Of course, you can hear him in the afternoon, Sunday through Friday, on Iowa Public Radio's classical music stream. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.